Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance FIL 240 for spring semester 2026.
Today, analysis of financial statements and ratios together. It's partly an exercise in showing you how to use Excel at a somewhat more sophisticated level, getting you past just basic things that are done in Excel, quick calculations and all that, and kind of leveling you up a little bit. We have a directive from the dean to make sure that all students are fully certified in Excel and are comfortable with using it so that when they go into the workforce, they have a fighting chance of showing that they can handle the corporate type of spreadsheets, which are usually very complicated affairs. And so these classes where it's mostly an Excel day are kind of that part of that mission we have. And I will provide you with financial statements you can upload to your computer. You can walk with me right through this, doing ratios and then analyzing them. But before we do that, a look at the numbers. And as we see, we had sort of a bear day going on, but it's here in the last trading hour or so. The market is groveling its way back up, on at least for us here in the U.S. markets. It's kind of groveling its way back up, trying to break through to exceed the close yesterday, but we'll see about that. On the other side of the world, the Asian markets, Japan was just not in a good mood, and we've been seeing more of those in the last few weeks, and it was down about 0.7% today, and that's kind of like every day seems to be a somewhat bearish over in the, on the Tokyo Exchange. But coming up here, we can see the Hang Seng just kind of stayed right about at zero all day. It kind of went down, and then it went up a little bit, and it finished up 0.05%, which basically means it finished flat from where it began for the day. Well, how did Australia was down a little bit, but it began to try to rally toward the end of the trading day over there. And that is actually kind of part of the Asian market, Australia is. But coming over to Europe, it was kind of an interesting day, and it was not didn't even look like this this morning, because everything hadn't closed yet over there. But if you look at, for example, looking at the CAC, it was up a good amount. The Paris Exchange seemed to be having a good day, up a little more than 1%. And Euronext, it tried to stay up, and then it just took a nosedive. That's like a composite index. But then if you look at the Financial Times, it rallied through the day, but then it kind of fell away at the end of the day. So, you know, there's that. And now over here, the Dow. The Dow up good 0.70%, but the S&P 500 had gone down through the day, and it started to rally just a little after midday, and it finished down only about 0.25%. I think these are done for the day. And then the NASDAQ, it dropped through the day, but then it started trying to rally, but it didn't get back up. So it was down for the day 1.25%. So it's kind of a complicated story. Now let me take you down here just a little bit. As I had told you before, gold went down tremendously last week. But as I said, it's not fundamentally a down market for gold. There's still a lot of concern about the future of the U.S. economy, and gold is reflecting that. Notice how it's rallied. It had a very strong start, but it fell down, and then it came back up a little bit. We're closing in again on $5,000 per ounce. So as I had said before, the longer-term outlook for gold is not down. It's still up. And that was just a clearing when the price dropped to about $4,700 an ounce. It's coming back up. Probably the next time we are together, it'll be above $5,000 an ounce again, because the fundamentals are pointing toward extraordinary weakness in the U.S. economy. But here's the one that's kind of troubling, is oil. Now, oil had been as low, the composite average was below, it was in the $56, $58 a barrel range, and now it's starting to come back up. $63.99, it's almost at $64 a barrel on the average composite. Brent is now beginning to get close to $70 a barrel, and that means eventually gasoline prices will recover. What is happening is the beginning of the supply contractions by OPEC. They opened up the floodgates, as I've said before, to drive the price of oil down to break the backs of the smaller oil producers. And they have done that. They're out. The landmen are gone. The wildcatters are going, are staying at the bar, drinking their sadness away. And now that means that OPEC can begin to contract the supply of oil, and they won't have any competitors jumping in. And so we could see it back up there, $80, $90 a barrel range, which means the gasoline prices right now are low. They will go up. Is that going to happen soon? Not dramatically, but it's going to slowly ease its way back up. Probably by spring break, we'll see $70 a barrel on oil, although I don't know about that. There still seem to be some of the independents out there producing, but who knows? Okay, so that's where we are. Now, taking it over here just for a moment to the sector map, you can see that this was actually more of a bear day than a bull day. The one sector that is almost always green is the technology sector, and today it's flashing red, as well as some other important sectors, large sectors. So it's a mixed bag. Bulls and bears were pushing back and forth, but this ginormic sector of the high technology stocks, it took a down day, and that's somewhat unusual. Let me take you over here. The company that I will use for financial analysis is Colgate-Palmolive, trading symbol CL. Let's look at its numbers just for a minute here. Colgate-Palmolive just released its earnings report for the last quarter of 2025. And guess what that did to the stock? Their estimate was below where the actual was. Here's what they said it, they thought it would be, and today they reported that the earnings per share was up here. That means that the stock, a lot of buying came in very fast on it, on that good news, that positive information just punched into the market hard. And then there was more, as analysts looked at why it was higher, there was this information about very good results overall for the quarter. And so you had another punch up. And right there, you begin to see it float, because that good information, earnings were more than they had been expected to be, and there were other good things in those financial statements. Notice how the market absorbed all of that information. And once that information was digested, it was no longer had anything to do with the stock price. The stock price, these were two accelerant punches. And then once those were gone, it just went back to floating at the new higher level of value, carrying that information that it had just put into the price. That's why we say that stock price, historical stock prices, don't help us very much, because it's already in the stock prices that we see. It doesn't disappear. It's in there just with whatever new information comes in from day to day or hour to hour. But Colgate-Palmolive, just to make sure that we have a view of what this company is, old, heavy-duty, a beta of 0.29, which means it's extraordinarily safe as an investment. And you will see why when we look at the actual financials and also look at the ratios, it all becomes very obvious that this is a very safe investment. And it pays a nice fat dividend, a nice dividend. It's not huge, but it's a dividend nonetheless. It's EPS, it's a profitable company, which you'll see. And its price earnings may be a little overvalued, especially with this punch here, but still fairly close to intrinsic value right now. And so with that, we then have a look at the numbers for this company. Now, I want you to go over here. And you go to your files. Now, we'll do two things. I want you to bring up that financial analysis ratios sheet. Now, remember, whenever you're getting stuff from files, you click on the three down vertical dots. Don't click on the words, because that just gives you kind of an image of what's in the file. Download it, and there it is. So we've got the financial ratios. And remember, you can print these out, and you can use those on any quiz, and you can also have this sheet with you for the midterm and the final. So there's no issue of you memorizing these. You'll get used to what they say on your own anyway with your homework and what I show you here in class. But be sure that you get a printout of it, because you can't, don't write anything on this, but it is there for you for the purposes of knowing what these ratios are telling us. Now, the next thing we're going to do is go back over here to the files. Now go to your spreadsheets. Spreadsheets. Now then click on class spreadsheets. And there you'll see Colgate-Palmolive. Click on the three dots down, download it, and then here we are. Enable it. We're just going to go through and do the calculations. Now you follow along with me, and I'll try to go slowly, but you'll see how we use formulas to reference other worksheets. From one worksheet to another, we can get formulas from information in multiple worksheets for our purposes at hand. Another thing you'll see today, I'll show you a few very minor tricks that you can do in Excel that most people don't know unless they're very familiar with it. So that's why we do these certifications. That's why I, in my classes, I always show what I am doing so that you, there's no mystery. How the heck did you do that? You see it. Maybe you'll remember, maybe you won't, but I show it to you anyway. As I did the last time, I'm going to put, click here on this balance sheet, and then I'm going to right click to insert a new worksheet. And I'll call that Ratios 1, because these came down from Standard & Poor's Global Net Advantages, Ratios 1. And they helpfully provide you with all the ratios I'm going to show you how to get. Okay, and so we have this. This is sort of like your scratch sheet. This is where you get calculations, and you can even print them out for a presentation or whatever without encumbering the presentation with all of the mess of numbers in the core data sheets themselves. I'm going to, let me expand this a little bit. Nope. I want to expand it a little bit so I can see what I'm doing here. Okay, a couple of things. Setup. I will want on this column A the names of the ratios. So column B will start with 2025. And then column C in the column 1, I'll put 2024. And then I'll run this over so that I've got the financials go back to 2021. so I'll do all those years. Notice how Excel can count for you. There are even more sophisticated ways, like the sequence function, if you want. So over here, we begin. And I'll be talking about these ratios as I do the calculations. What do they mean? What is the common sense of them? I always begin with liquidity ratios. Now, under the liquidity ratios, there are three classics which are on your ratios formula sheet. The first one is the current ratio. The second one, down to row four, is the quick ratio. Now, remember that this is also called the acid test. And you'll hear me use the term acid sometimes, you know, if I'm not thinking about the more fancy terms. And then there's a last one called the cash ratio, which you may hear me call the burn ratio from time to time. Now, here we go. The current ratio simply compares all of your current assets to your current liabilities. So I will say equals in column B3, I'll put equals. And then I go to the balance sheet and I click on total current assets, which is 5709, divided by, and then I go down here and find my total current liabilities, which are 5736, and I hit enter, and it snaps me back. And I get 0.9952. This tells us that the current assets and the current liabilities are almost the same. Put another way, our current assets can cover our current liabilities one time over. Here's where I show you something in Excel. Nope, I don't want to. I'm going back up here to B3. Most people think that Excel, you can't put units of measure in Excel, because then Excel would think that the number was just a word. That's actually not true. You can put anything you want. Miles, kilograms, degrees Fahrenheit, whatever you want as a label, and Excel will still take it as a number. Now, these liquidity ratios are actually, their units of measure are a little time symbol. So the current ratio says that our current assets can cover current liabilities 0.9952 times over. Well, how would I put a little time symbol in there, but still have Excel recognize it as a number? It's done like this. You go to that column, that cell B3, and you right click, format the cells. Go down here to custom. And you see that in that box, the word general? Delete that. And in its place, type 0.00. That tells Excel to show them to two decimal places of accuracy. And then open a quote, quotation mark. Put a space and a little times, a little X, and then close the quotes. Watch what happens. You get the symbol. Now you could put quote space miles, quote space grams, whatever you want. As long as Excel, you do it in a custom format, in quotes, it'll do it for you. And I did it to two decimal places of accuracy. Now we'll do the quick ratio. Now the quick ratio says, okay, not all current assets are super liquid. Inventory is actually not liquid at all. You can't get rid of your inventory overnight. If you wanted to, you'd have to sell it to some factoring agent for pennies on the dollar. So what we do with this one is, I say equals, I type equals, and then I'm going to open parentheses because I'm going to go over to the balance sheet and I'll take the current, total current assets, but subtract inventory. Where the heck is it? Oh, there it is. That's the 2032. Then I close the parentheses and divide by the current liabilities. Total current liabilities, 5736. And I'll do the same for cash. Cash is just your cash divided by your, in other words, if you had to pay all your total, your current liabilities off right away, really all you have is cash to do that. But there's a little bit of controversy on that one. I'll say equals, and then I go over to the balance sheet, and I go up here and I look for cash. But I see cash and equivalents, and then I see short-term investments. And I see trading assets, securities, there's nothing there. There are some analysts, textbooks, that say, just do the cash and equivalents. Others say, do the cash and equivalents and short-term assets, because you can turn those into cash with the push of a button. You can get them back into cash. So my way is to take your total cash and short-term investments. That would be the 1395. Divided by your total current liabilities, 5736. Before I go on, I wanted to show you that formatting trick again on these. You click on the cell where you want units of measure. Right click, and then say click on Format Cells. Go down to Custom. Delete the general and type in how many decimal places of accuracy you want. I'm going to do 2. If I wanted 4, I'd say 0.0000. But I'll do 2. And then you open quotation marks, and then you put a space, and you put whatever units you want. In this case, I'm going to put a little time symbol, and then close the quotation marks. Out of curiosity, how many of you knew this trick? I'm getting a silence. It's very cool because then your spreadsheets look so much more professional. Enter. And then I'll do it one more time just to reinforce it. I'm going to put the cell, go to cell B5, right click, format cells, go to custom, get rid of the general, and I'll type in 0.00, open parentheses, space, and then put whatever units of measure you want in there. You could put miles, pounds, whatever, LBS. Close the quotation marks. What do you mean? Oh, I'm not paying attention. Oh, duh. Try it again, 0.00, open quotation marks, space, times, quotation mark. There you go. Just one of those things that, one of those little nuanced tricks that isn't hard to remember, but it is nice. Okay, we've gotten that. We can see that by the time we get to cash, the company could, if it all it had was cash and it had to pay its liability, current liabilities today, it could pay about 0.24 of the, about 24% of them. That's what that's telling you. Now the next one that next category I'll do is profitability. Now, in order, these are gross margin, then operating margin, and net margin. And these two, return on assets and return on equity. Now, these we will be jumping from income statement to balance sheet for the numerator versus the denominator and all that. Gross margin, it's straight up. All you do is say equals gross profit or gross income, whatever you want to call it, which is 12. You go over there to the income statement. You click on 12,251. Then you divide that by your revenue, 2382. Now, what this tells us, there are different ways to say it, but the one that is the most common sense is that of every dollar that came into the cash registers of the company, 60 cents of it survived wholesale cost. So in other words, wholesale cost, you use 40 cents of that to make the dollar in terms of buying the wholesale stuff. Now the operating is similar, except that equals, you go to the income statement and you click on operating income, which sometimes is called EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes on some. But you click on that, 4291, and then you divide that by your revenue, your total revenue. Actually, I should have clicked on total. They're the same, total revenue and just revenue. But there you go, the 2382. Now this one tells us that of every dollar that came into the cash register, 21 cents survived your wholesale costs and all of your operating costs. Wages, salaries, meals and entertainment, shipping, whatever, sales, general and administrative expenses. Now the net margin, that one is where we go clear down on equals and go to the income statement and go clear down to net income. Clear down here on it, I think that's B59 on the income statement. And we divide that one by our total revenue. This is the important one. This says that of every dollar that came into the cash registers, 10 cents of it belongs to the shareholders. Net income is after all the debts have been paid in their timely manner. So that's 10 cents. Now, some of that 10 cents could go to dividends. The rest of the 10 cents would go back into the company to grow the company and hopefully grow the stock. Now, return on assets is a very normal number, and I cannot for the life of me figure out. Return on equity is insane with this company, and I honestly, I was blindsided by it. I never would have imagined. You just don't see numbers like that. But anyway, return on assets is easy. You just take equals your net income divided by your on the balance sheet your total assets. Stop. I don't know why it did that to me. Equals, and you take your net income, 2132, divided by your total assets, which are right here, 16,330. This number is telling you that if all of your assets are like a portfolio, what did that portfolio earn for the year? Well, it earned 13%. That's all it's telling you is take the company as just an investment portfolio. All of its assets are the pieces of its portfolio. And how much did that make you in net income for the year? 13%. That's pretty healthy. It's not spectacular, but it's healthy. Now, this is the one that drives me crazy because I don't know how it could be this number. Normally, return on equity is a little larger, just a somewhat larger than return on assets. Now, keep this in mind, that return on assets is net income divided by total assets. But return on equity is net income divided by only part of the total assets, the shareholders' equity. So that's why, by mathematical definition, return on equity will be a larger number than return on assets, because the denominator of return on equity is just part of what is in the denominator of return on assets. But as you'll see, there is absolutely, this is insane, this number equals, and we're going to take net income divided by the 2132 divided by, and then we're going to go over here to the balance sheet and say, okay, what is the total shareholders' equity of this company? Total equity. 365. And that cannot be right. That just can't be. That's an insanely large number. Now here's what I do. The profitabilities, don't even look at that in return on equity. I don't know what's going on with that. These five numbers are all percentages. Now that was pretty easy. You go up to the ribbon, the home ribbon, and there's a percent. Just click and say, make those percents. And then I will scoot them over a little bit to two decimal places. You just click that 0.00 and the little arrow pointing to the left, and that'll add decimal places to it. Where the hell is my coffee? Oh, there it is. Sorry. Oh, okay. Much better. Okay, so anyway. Now, the next ones that I will do here are the asset activity ratios. Before I do that, I need to tell you something here. You see that return on assets? Always keep an eye on that, because some companies will have a very high return on assets, ROA, but it's for a very wrong reason. A company that does not replace fixed assets will just depreciate away its asset base. When it buys or replaces assets, total assets go up because fixed assets go up. But if a company just ignores its property, plant, and equipment and just lets it depreciate away, that will naturally make total assets decline. And that will then mathematically make ROA go up. So you got to be careful about that. There's a story back from my time. It was actually right during my time it was happening, and before that. The oil refineries down along the coast, the Gulf Coast, were quite a thing. They were put up in the 60s and 70s, and they cracked oil all the time. And as demand went up, oil, more oil was being brought in. They did worked harder and harder. But the companies never really did a lot of replacement of the refineries. They didn't upgrade them, put in new technologies, the same technology. And so over time, they were depreciated away until those oil refineries had very low net after depreciation value. So total assets were going down because they were working these assets way past their time, not replacing them. So ROA was going up and up and up. And of course that, wow, look at those companies. Those ROAs are to die for. Well, they actually were. Because by the time we got to the late 90s and the early 2000s, those old refineries that had never been upgraded, never been maintained, started to explode. And a lot of those were near communities where the workers' families lived that were at the worked at the refineries. There were absolute wipeouts of people, workers, families in the community surrounding them, all because they had not been keeping up on upgrading the equipment at those refineries. So those ROAs going up and up and up, the first thing you have to ask yourself is, why? Are they going up because they are adding new equipment, because they're not adding new equipment, which would make fixed assets go back up, net fixed assets go up? Or are they just letting, yeah, that sounds like that's what's going on. And then you have to ask yourself, how long can they keep doing this before those old assets that have been depreciated to virtually zero start giving out on them and causing catastrophes? Just a side note there. Okay, asset activity. Let me show you that sheet here briefly, just to make sure you're on the page with me. The ones that I will pay attention to are total asset turnover, fixed asset turnover, and inventory turnover. So what I'll do is, and they're all, the first two are net sales. So I will come back over here. Where the heck am I? Okay. Asset activity, total asset turnover, fixed asset turnover, and then inventory turnover. So fixed asset turnover, and that will be sales over fixed total asset turnover. If you look at the formula, say net sales over total assets. So we'll go back here and we'll say, okay, equals, now we go to the income statement first to get sales, net sales, total revenue, 2382, divided by, now we jump over to the balance sheet and grab the total assets, which are 16,330. This is telling us that the value of all of the assets of the company was turned over in sales more than once a year, about 1.2 times, maybe about every 9 months. This company completely recreates its total assets. It doesn't do it physically, but in terms of financially, that's what it does. Now, the fixed assets, you do the same thing, equals on the top, net income, or rather sales, total sales, revenue, 2382, divided by, here's where I would recommend as a best practices, go after net property, plant, and equipment for the denominator. That's 4660. So as far as fixed assets are concerned, they turned their property, plant, and equipment over more than four times a year. They turned it over, putting it in another way, they turned their fixed assets over a little more than once every quarter. That's pretty good. I mean, it's not like these new high-tech companies that have ridiculously high numbers, but that's nothing to sneeze at. Now, the next one. We're going to look at cost inventory turnover. Now, this one will take cost of goods sold, which is 8134 on the income statement, divided by, we go to the balance sheet and divide it by inventory. Where the heck is inventory? There it is, 2032. That means that about every 3 months, they wiped out their entire inventory and replaced it with new inventory. Now, by the modern standards, this is pathetically low because, well, it should be above 12 or 20 or something. These, you'll see why this is not Colgate-Palmolive's way. It's just not what they do. Their inventory is turned over about once every quarter, four times a year. As a matter of fact, if I wanted to, I'll just show you. I won't do this, but watch this one. I'm going to put the units on this. Format the cells. Custom. Wipe out the general. I want two decimal places. Just to show you some fancy stuff. Matter of fact, I'll even put that there. Like I said, I mean, once you get the hang of it, there are ways that you can copy it down. But anyway, I'll undo that. I just wanted to show you that you can do any kind of label you want on a number. Okay, that was fun. These don't tell us a lot until we look at them in the context of the trends or the stability of the ratios from year to year, which we'll do in a bit. But the next one we'll do is debt management ratios. Now, the first one is debt to total assets. We will also do times interest earned. And we'll do this oddball called times EBITDA earned. That last one, EBITDA, I swear it's been in the last 10 years, I've heard corporate types, instead of saying operating income, they say EBITDA. It is operating income, but you add back depreciation and amortization. In other words, when you subtract out the depreciation and amortization, you're subtracting out something that really doesn't exist. There is no such thing as physically money going out to depreciation or amortization. So this EBITDA is operating income, but you add back depreciation and amortization. Now, if you have to do it by hand, it's kind of a pain, but Colgate-Palmolive reports EBITDA, and so we'll use that one. But debt to total assets, let me do that one. The first thing is that's equal to long-term debt divided by total assets. Long-term debt. And the book follows this as well as I do, and everyone else does. So we'll go over equals onto the balance sheet and we find just under liabilities, long-term debt. Don't use other parts of liabilities, just the long-term debt. And then you divide that by your total assets. This is essentially a measure of the leverage of the company. And this one is surprisingly high for such an old company. This is a high one. Now, I will introduce you to a term here, capital structure. Capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that comprises total assets. Capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that comprises total assets. Capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that comprises capital structure. Now, what we're seeing here is that Colgate-Palmolive's capital structure is about 49% debt and 51% equity. That capital structure indicates a noticeable leverage. In other words, this is more of a more leveraged company than we might expect. I mean, if that were 0.25, I'd say that's a typically leveraged company. But here, the capital structure has more debt than we would normally see in a company this old. A lot of young companies are just, they borrow money hand over fist. But this company has a pretty substantial capital structure. Now here's the weird part. I'm going to do times interest earned now. Times interest earned is simply how many times over your operating income can pay the interest that's due. So we say here, the times interest earned equals, we go over here to the income statement. What was their operating income? Well, it was $42.91. Now we divide that by their interest expense. Here's where I have to do something. Companies almost always report the interest expense as a negative. But that would make the ratio negative, so I usually put ABS open parentheses just so that I get a positive number there. And then click on that negative 192, and then I close the parentheses because I did a function absolute value. And that will keep the ratio from being negative. Okay. This is saying that Colgate-Palmolive can pay its interest with the cash available to pay the interest 22 times over. That is actually a very high number. That's a high number. You'll see 6, 8, 12. What's really mystifying about it is that Colgate has a lot of debt. Look at its capital structure there. 49% debt, which means there'd be a lot of interest payments, and yet the company still, it could pay its interest expense 22 times over. That's a little surprising. That much debt, but they still have a very high times interest earned. Now, EBITDA times EBITDA earned, times EBITDA, I would just do the same thing, except that instead of using operating income, I would use EBITDA. So I'll have to fish that out. Some companies don't report it, but they do over here on the income statement. I have to go down here, and I see EBITDA. There it is. and I'll use that instead of operating income. Then divide that by the absolute value of the interest expense. So I'll do ABS, open parentheses, and then I'll click on that net interest expense. So it's a little higher because you don't have the numerator doesn't have that drag of depreciation and amortization in it. Now, if you wanted to do this manually, what you would do is you would take operating income and then manually subtract, in parentheses, manually subtract the depreciation and amortization. But fortunately, Colgate does give us EBITDA, so we don't have to worry about it. Okay, now, what else do I have here? What am I missing? Oh. These, market value. Here's the problem with doing market value. You need the price, so you would have to run to a service that gives you the current price, and then run back over to your sheets and divide by earnings per share. So it gets to be kind of a pain to do these, and I would not do this on an exam or a quiz. And the book gives you sort of a simple example for doing it. But the one, this is one that's actually kind of important here, but it is nasty tricky because you can find the market cap. You go to Yahoo or something like that to find the market cap. And then you run back to your spreadsheet and divide by the book value. The problem with doing that is that the units that are used in a service like Yahoo or something like that, and the units that are used in the financial statements themselves might be different. One might be in billions, the other might be in hundreds of millions. And so you might get a false number because the units of thousands don't match up. Now, if I am thinking correctly, and I might be wrong about this, I'm going to try to do market to book here, just to humor myself. Market ratios, and I'll do market to book. The first thing I'll have to do is go over here to Yahoo Finance and see what the market cap is. They're listing a market cap of $76.595 billion. So you would have to put that in manually. Equals $76.595 billion. Now here's where the problem comes in. Because when I go over here to the balance sheet to look at total shareholders' equity, I see this number right here. But I am not convinced that that is also in billions. I think that is in hundreds of millions. So I would have to, or tens of millions. Or maybe in billions, I don't know. I am going to take a stab that that is actually $36.5 billion. So I'll go back over here to my ratios and divide by 56.4. No, by 5.64. I think that's right. I would not do this on an exam or a quiz because you just don't know just quickly looking at things. And that comes up with a market to book of about 13.58. That, if that's correct, that says that every dollar stockholders, owners have put into the company through buying the stock, through giving up dividends, The company has turned that into $13.58 of equity value. It's kind of what it says. But again, I can't, you know, I'm not going to hold you to that. I don't know it, so I'm going to delete it. Just leave it alone, drop it right there. Okay, all of that is now done. So what we're going to do now is take these numbers and we're going to send them over. Whoops. Didn't mean to do that. And we're going to drag them over to F. And there are 5 years of ratios, all there. And now we can do the real thing. We can say, what do these numbers tell us? If I look at the liquidity ratios, we can see that the company has tightened up its liquid assets a little bit. Notice that it kind of went very high. Now, it's not a good idea. Now, companies can be above one, below one. But when you have a number like you saw, they had this number right here in 2022 of 1.28. It looks to me like they thought that was too much liquidity. Because if you keep cash, you're giving up investments in long-term equipment that can earn the company money. And you can see that they corrected that, and they've brought it down to this level of 1.00. So you can almost see the operating thinking of management of the company through here. The quick ratio has stayed relatively stable. It did have that spike, but their quick ratio, in other words, taking out inventory, what is really liquid, has been fairly stable. Now, their cash management has been very stable over this time period, keeping about the same amount of cash relative to current liabilities. You see the discipline here of old long-time management policies. They're holding everything tight. And there, you'll see this more down here. You look at their gross margin. Cost of goods sold was hurting them a few years back. But notice how they brought it back into line at about 60%. You notice how close these numbers are. You see young companies, these ratios are all over the place. Operating margin, again, tight discipline. Now net margin took a jump and then it dropped back down. And we can see that the revenues sank in 2025 somewhat. But we see ROA, at least ROA, it jumped here because your net income jumped, but then it came back down into sort of midway among the ones that weren't in the jump. Total asset turnover. They have been increasing the work of their total assets to generate net income. It's been drifting upward over time as they get more efficient with their use of their total assets. However, their fixed assets they've been also working harder too. So most of this is the fixed assets being pushed a little harder. Now the inventory turnover. Notice how that stays right around 4. It bounces a little bit, but they have clearly decided they want to turn inventory over about every 3 months. They're not going to try to do just in time. They're not going to try to force their inventory through and sell it faster and faster. They've got a policy, and they're holding to it. Now, this is an interesting one here. Their leverage has kind of wavered. See how it went up here? Kind of up. In other words, they took on a lot of debt in 2022. But then they got it back out and got it a little bit more under control. And then times interest earned, they are earning, but they are not using, but they're not having more interest expense. The bottom line that I'm bringing up here, that what you're seeing is a company, why it has that beta of 0.29. The stability of these ratios over a long period of time, over 5 years, you can see that there is a very tight rein by the management on the expenditures and all of that, of the, both short-term and long-term of the company. They don't try to push ratios higher. They don't try to do anything but do what they have always done. Now, when you're talking about investors, the ones who are the most important are things like pension funds, trust funds. They don't want wild ratios. They want safe investments. And Colgate-Palmolive is a classic example of a safe investment. The idea that every company has to be an Nvidia or something like that, or a Tesla, or one of those companies like that. Not really. The long-haul investors want to see what we see here, stability, and over a long period of time. In other words, a management that doesn't rock the boat. It sounds like it's not very interesting, very fun, but then again, when you're investing billions and billions of dollars, you don't want fun. You want at least some certainty that you're going to make a buck. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.